Thank you. Thank you so much. Listen. How y'all doing? Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. I have received your questions, actually, that some of you have submitted online, so I will get to those questions. But first of all, welcome, Wynton. It's a pleasure to have you with us exploring your music and being able to look at the way that you think about music and what it represents. And probably for me, the one thing that I've always loved and have always been fascinated with, it's the notion that you always search for the true essence and the meaning behind any musical gesture. And I feel like music to you, even dots on a piece of paper, are just a conduit to communicate something that is a lot more personal and a lot more human and deep. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you approach this or how you think about this?
Yeah, that's how I look at it. You covered it. You know, it's like when I see you and Cheryl with Benny and Maria, just the fundamentals of a familial life, how you talk, you raise your eyebrows, how y'all communicate around your kids in the cycle. That they're very young now, 8, and you know they're babies, but they're gonna grow, and they are. Once I was in a restaurant with a really good friend of mine. Now she's maybe 15 years older than me, and we were talking for about an hour and 15 minutes, very intensely, and I was almost on her lap listening to what she was telling me. So somebody in a restaurant, it's in New York City, was wondering, what is this black dude talking to this white lady that's 15 years older than him? What could they possibly be discussing with this type of intensity? So he couldn't help himself. So when I went to left, he said, what were you talking about with that lady? I said, that's a real good friend of mine for many years. We're talking about both of her mother died of dementia and my mother has it. And he looked at me and said, oh, fundamentals. So that's how I like to look at things. I think that when you try to learn music from other cultures, the most difficult thing to learn is what does something mean? What does a gesture mean? And a lot of times our misunderstanding of other people's culture and who they are comes from a fundamental lack of understanding of meaning. And because music is the art of the invisible and it lives in the world of all things like the imagination, dream states, projections into the future, memories, things like greed, envy, things that we can't, that are so tangible but not, there's a tendency to want to escape into a soundscape. A soundscape in music is so interesting just as an art form. Sounds, you can just create endless sounds. It's like first time you get a Kurzweil or something, you just touch every button on there. But the meaning aspect of it are those things that touch human beings, I feel, the most, especially collectively. And we experience that most often in church. Or in some type of spiritual, and something like a civil rights movement when people start to chant the same song over and over again. And in the East, when people are chanting, or they say om, or they spin, I try to see what is our collective understanding and our experience, and how can we channel that through whatever our forms and our styles of music are. And that means a lot to me. That's why I return to the same gestures over and over again.
And, you know, it always seems to me like each one of your pieces has such a long and beautiful thought out history of the progression of those gestures, you know, and how they have been transformed through time and how history has changed and people have put their own influences on that groove or on that beat. Or how do you decide what is the progression of that? You know what I mean? In the music, because it's, you know, it changes.
That's like listening to Tandoon's piece. Last night we were talking about it. When he chose to make certain changes to his music to maintain the interest of the audience. I'm always thinking about the effect a form will have on a group of people who are listening to it. And I always write all of my forms out, not as music, as words. And I'm always very much the opposite of the belief that music goes in the direction of now it's modern or it's not modern, because we don't live life in that way. Some of the most progressive moments you probably had in your life was with people who've passed away. And kids can be older than you. My oldest son was always older than me. I could depend on him to make me be more mature. He'd just look at me. I'd be in a cab, argue with a cab driver. He would go. Is that the humanity you're always talking about? So I'm very serious about all aspects of form, because there's a type of condescension that I have been subject to for years about American music, about what our music is about the fundamentals of it, how serious they are, and that we should be imitating people from Europe. No disrespect, of course, to Europe or European music, because as you know, we've discussed a mutual respect. But our culture has afforded a lot that we just left on the table. And I believe in those things, so I don't go to those things out of naivete or inability to address musical sophistication. I very much choose to have grooves, to have blues. You're gonna hear fife and drums. I choose to do that. I choose to embrace that heritage, write marches, have a New Orleans dialogue, deal with the relation between a man and a woman. I don't care whether people think gender is just a construct. They can keep believing that. I don't believe that. So I'm gonna have those two people talking to one another. They're gonna have those perspectives. I believe in the train. It's funny, I was on my way back to the home that we're staying in here. There were a bunch of people in someone's front yard, and we're saying, man, why would all these people be in this front yard? And we looked, and the person of that home has a huge train outside going around in their front yard, and everybody has their kids there in the neighborhood looking at it. And you know, these things are fundamental things, and I try to find forms that will take us through a progression, because our lives are all progression, the progression of a day, the progression in a family. And I think about those types of things because in my experience, I've known people of all ages all the time. I had a guy come to my dressing room one night. This man had to be 95 years old. And I didn't want to ask him his age, but I was looking at him, and he started to talk to me about music. And he said, I like your daddy's piano playing. Then all of a sudden, he started to cry. And he looked at me and said, I miss my father so much. Now, if you could imagine, I'm looking at a guy that's like 95, and he said, you have a daddy? But it was so striking, so I hugged the man, you know. It was just me and him. I hugged him, and he looked at me, and he said, treasure your father while you have him. So I asked him, how old are you? He said, I'm 97 years old. I said, damn. So I think that the kind of cycle of life and the progression is important for us to have to not take fundamentals out of our music for some type of theoretical, man, something nobody even cares about most of the time. Because music theory is not like science theory. It's not the same thing. I mean, there's a fantastic science to music, and it is very real. But there's another aspect to music that is super science. That means the closest thing is also the furthest away.
Just because we got so many questions about this, do you want to talk a little bit about, a lot of people were curious how are the challenges in writing for the violin versus, you know, playing? Like, actually, there was a question that said, do you wish you play the violin?
Where's Nikki? No. I'm a trumpet player. We don't. Once you get to the top of the food chain, you don't look. You don't. We don't look at these other instruments with envy. Yeah. Probably the only instrument we ever looked at with envy was the electric guitar, because they play louder than us.
So
it's not because of what they're playing. It's right. Because of the volume of it.
That's right.
When we hear what they play, we say, okay.
Well. You know, I teach the conducting students. I said, you always go with the loudest instrument of the orchestra, which is 90% of the time, I just conduct the trumpet section.
Talk about it. Yeah, that's called priorities.
That's right. Or being realistic, really.
Yeah, look at where those
reality.
Lines. Yeah.
So, one of the movements in the symphony tonight, you said that you wrote it as if you were playing it on the trumpet, like as if you were improvising it. And I'm just wondering, when you come up with like the very beginning of the violin concerto, which is so not just that it's beautiful, but it's so perfect for the violin, you know what I mean? Like, did that idea come out of the trumpet or out of playing it, or was it just a thought? I'm curious.
Yeah, I never hear the trumpet when I'm playing music. Literally, that movement is the only time I've ever played and written anything. I only hear like the thought and idea, because the violin concerto is for Nikki. It was only the thought of her and what she would like to play. And also, I had the opportunity to just ask her, because I knew her for many years. What key should it be in with this, with that, send me? And I love violin music. I love folk music. I studied a lot of violin music when I was trying to learn how to write American music. So I would take, like, I would go in the Lincoln Center Library and they would make tapes for me, and I would just do-ba-do-do-do-dee-do-ba-dee-ba-dee-do-da-dee-da-dee-ba-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. So I was trying to learn how to improvise in that language, so if I wrote, I could write not a folk tune, but I could invent music that is in the American vernacular tradition. Growing up in the American band system of our generation, we played Vaughn Williams and Host, and, you know, the kind of Anglo-American thematic material. We also had square dancing in elementary school. When they were trying to take everything black out of schools, it was the whitest dance they could find. So you did square dancing. However, there was a lot that's great in a square dance. So even though at that time you did not want to do the square dance because you understood it was an attempt to remove black people from stuff yet again. However, what was in it was much more than you thought was in it before you started to do it. Then when you start having somebody calling, dancing, your do-si-do, your partner, round and round, you start to do these things that are unbelievably corny at that time, in the middle of like Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, Earth, Wind, Fire. The education of that has stayed with me, and there's much, then when you start to learn about Texas fiddling style, a Texas caller, and read interviews about who was a great caller and what they did, and as my education has grown, I was fortunate to have many experiences in youth that I didn't reject, and also a father who was always saying, go check this out. And I've been, man, I don't want to check this corny stuff. Go check this out, man. You know? And it's always important for me to get into an instrument. Every instrument is so beautiful. It's like a person. When you could see people, really, the range of us, my father had a thing that he would have us do in the beginning of the school year. Four of us would stand in the middle of a classroom, and he would say, we stand back to back, and he would say, describe what you see. So one person, I see the exit sign, I see the window. Another person say, I see an exit sign, I see a bar, I see this, I see trash cans. Another person say, oh, I see seats. I see another person say, oh, I see this, I see three people. And he would say, are those the same thing? And you say, no, obviously. He said, are we in the same room? Then he would say, now, think of how much all of y'all together did not see this in this room. That's how people are. That's how music is. That's how everything on earth is. You think you know something only from your perspective you do not know. And I was fortunate to have him, so I love the instruments, you know. I love violin. The sound of it, the fiddle tunes, beautiful violin concertos, the sound of Haydn's music. I remember the first time I was 14, I played with a professional orchestra, New Orleans Philharmonic. I was playing Haydn trumpet concerto. And it's always some ironic thing. So I'm gonna tell y'all a story that's 1,000% true, but it's ironic, and it shows like something about life. So I'm from a subdivision of New Orleans that's called Pigeontown. And in Pigeontown, we call it Pigeontown. We hate the subdivision next to us. That subdivision is called Holly Grove. Holly Grove is where Lil Wayne is from. So if you're from Pigeontown, you can't stand Holly Grove. So I got the information of where the symphony's rehearsal was. It was in the morning at 10 o'clock. I won a competition to play a concerto, and it was only on a whim. You know, I mean, I didn't think I would win. I'm a trumpet player, whatever. I walked to the rehearsal, and damn if it wasn't in Holly Grove. So I'm thinking to myself, man, these people rehearsing in Holly Grove. Damn. And that's where it was, in the middle of the hood. I walked in the room, and it was like maybe a bit of movie theater or something, and there was the New Orleans Philharmonic set up. I'd never been in a room of adults who are all white. I grew up in segregation, basically. And just, what are all these people doing here? These adults, they're there, they're setting up. And then all of a sudden, you know, people tuned up, then they played that first chord. I never forget the sound of that chord, right? I'm getting goosebumps now. Because I'm looking at them, I'm 14, I got my trumpet, I'm in Holly Grove, oh, the white people are here, they're playing some symphonic music. I heard it on records with Maurice Andre. I never experienced it. And all of a sudden, boom, I'm hearing this sound. Wow, big E flat major chord, right? And I look around at everybody and I'm thinking, damn, the sound of a lot of people doing something. Think about how rare that is. And it's, boom, yeah, first chord is beautiful. So all the times I played that concerto after that, when I went on tour, I never played that. When I heard that chord, I did not evoke immediately that feeling and that emotion. And that's part of the job we have as musicians. That's why we should never divorce ourselves from the past, because I was very much myself, very much modern, very much present, very much hating being in Holly Grove, very much knowing I had to sneak back home after a certain time because they would know I'm from Pigeontown, and they were sitting there at New Orleans Philharmonic, and that was a big E-flat major chord voiced by Haydn. So we start to think of how things are connected. So yeah, I love the violin, I love the bassoon. I sat next to a great bassoon player, Milan Turkovich, when we did a version of Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale. I was already 30-something years old and playing, and the first time in my life I sat next to a bassoon. You know, everybody loves bassoon because of Pete and the Wolf. But I'm sitting next to him, and man, hey, I love him. He's like, you know, I'm like, damn, I love this guy. First thing he tells me when I go to sit down is, where's your score, man? I mean, what are you talking about, man? I got my part. He said, we all have scores. And from there, you know, our friendship has just developed. And I mean, he's retired. He's conducting now. But, you know, it's human relationships are also reflected in instruments. These instruments have personalities like your brothers and sisters. And you have to embrace the personality of these the instruments. The great Mary Lou Williams, phenomenal pianist, arranger, wrote hits all through the swing era, was the greatest female instrumentalist in the history of jazz, composer, intellectual, teacher, taught Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie. That's why nobody's ever heard of her. Unbelievable level of piano virtuosity. You can't believe it. 21, 22 years old, the recordings a woman made. She said, I never fell in love with men. I always fell in love with instruments.
And, you know, obviously you come from an unbelievable family. And the you know, everyone in your family has achieved really incredible, wonderful things. And one of the questions that we had, actually, people wanted to know: Do you feel like you've had you've been influenced in your music by your siblings, or is there more influence from one or another, or how is that interaction? You know, because you all do so many incredible things.
Sure, my big brother, Branford, yeah. I mean, I grew up in the same room with him. He taught me how to speak English. Everything about just what I realized about the world, and we were very, very much opposites. I was always very combative, always fighting, always angry. When I was younger, he was the opposite of that. He was always, hey, man, relax. Or don't worry about this. You know, he had kind of a rough time growing up because he wasn't like he wasn't predatory as a person. He was very symbiotic, so he struggled in our environment. I did not struggle in our environment. But I learned a lot watching him. He's an unbelievable musician. How he could hear instruments, he could play. He did so many things. You know, I could just laugh about things. Always me and him riding our bike everywhere. Scrapes or fights, we would get into stuff. A lot of times he'd look at me like, man, you really this crazy. And yeah, I would say out of my siblings, it would be my brother, Branford. I just learned the most. And always being around him, I took so much for granted. We always playing horn parts together, always practice together. I just took for granted somebody could just play harmonies. It wasn't until I played with other people I realized, man, my brother could have played this. My brother plays this stuff like it's nothing. Because you don't realize, you know, just a guy you grew up with. It just, my brother could play piano. We used to play talent shows in New Orleans. We had a funk band. That's the main thing we did in high school. And we play in it was for the police department in areas that they were trying to get people to feel kindly toward the police. And, you know, it wasn't like it is. It's not, I mean, it's the same, but it wasn't like, We didn't think nothing about it. I mean, the people like the police that we work with, everybody loved this guy named Bertrand Turner, always lying about he's going to get you a break and your band and all this. And once again, everything was segregated, so it was a different vibe. Once we forgot somebody's song on the talent show, man, you have no idea where we were. Like, it was not the right place to forget a song, to forget to ever hear somebody's song. This guy was walking on the stage, and we start, who knows their song? Oh, it's just rippling through the band. We're like, man, we might not get out here alive. And that's not a joke. That was a real consideration. So my brother goes, man, I heard it. It's like he is. He said, I heard it a couple of times. He said, I'll play the piano on it. So he looked at the bass player and said, E. And I'm telling you, he played that whole song, never having played it. And he took us through that song while these people were doing it. And we just looked at him and laughed. That's how he was always so quick and such a great musician in many ways.
So another question that came up from someone that was watching the rehearsals, they were asking, both in the violin concerto and the symphony, you don't use any saxophones. Why?
No, because I feel like you're not going to get your stuff played if you start putting too many saxophones in it. And I play with saxophones all the time. So I'm also trying to learn how to write for an orchestra. And I want to see, can an orchestra create the feeling and the groove and the things that are in American music, Anglo-American music, and Afro-American music. We're so used to them being separated by the marketplace that we forget that they were wedded in the American experience before the marketplace had to segregate them in the cause of racism. And when you talk to any great musician, if you talk to any great musician in these traditions, like Willie Nelson, if you're sitting down and talking with him, the music is segregated now, but in his experience, he learned how to play the way he learned how to play. And it goes for all the musicians, you know. I think if somebody from Russia taught Jack Johnson how to fight. And it's just the kind of way that our lives are intertwined for some reason is never a part of our mythology because we want to be what we are. And we've achieved that. But in my music and the things I do, I try to fulfill the things that my father always taught us, not to be prejudiced, not to be ignorant. And I saw him many times stand in barbershops alone in the 1970s, which was not an era of we love white folks. I saw him stand alone in his opinion against the type of rhetoric that was very popular and maybe even justified at that time. And I would always tell him, man, why are you saying all this Uncle Tom stuff in front of these people? You say, man, you always attack the problem that's in front of you. You don't attack a problem over here. And I feel like now our nation, of course, we're so obviously sunk to such a low level at this point in terms of the corruption and our integrity. Nobody, it's hard to question it. And that's across our sectors. I try with my music to always be respectful of all of my mentors and all of the help that I receive from all of the musicians. I want to have when we play with the orchestra, some of the members I knew when they were younger, some have teachers that I knew, some, and the type of collegial respect that we have. Of course, our trumpet players, we're from that same kind of lineage of American trumpet players, a basic love we have of each other and the same people we know. I want that to be in my music, and I want it to be something that brings generations and races of people together under our own experience without being fake or putting a smile on something that's a turd. You know, I mean, it's hard to be for real a lot of times when you're being required to be unreal. But because reality is what it is, the facet of it that you can see, if you state it with enough clarity and it can be corroborated with some type of life experience, people can come to it. No matter how far apart you start from them, they can come to it.
Well, this was something that was fascinating to me, and maybe it was just for me, but I think the musicians also felt this way. When you kept talking during rehearsals about the fact that, you know, coming together in a groove, it's not necessarily something that you're smiling about. Right.
Yeah, it's always a thing. Like it's always like I call it a plantation vibe. What are those darkies doing down there? Yeah, they're having a good time, boss. That's, you know, when people have really dysfunctional environment they can't do anything about, and they're surrounded by the kind of unmentionable. I guess the closest you can come to that would be kind of people who give you accounts of what it was like to be in the Holocaust, or people who are part of any of these type of human tragedies, which exist in cultures across human history, for them to be able to dance and to smile and to figure out how to come together and play, that's a hell of an achievement. We have a tendency, if we play European music, what we call classical music, that whenever a groove comes up, we don't play it well first, then we start smiling. It's like what jazz musicians do to Afro-Latin music. What we play has nothing to do with the people's music, but we're just having a good time, Latin. And if a real person from that tradition sees you and likes you, when you're smiling, they'll be like, man, why are you looking at us like that? Y'all are not playing this music right at all. Then that's when that kind of arrogance and condescension comes into question. Then you start telling them how their music should be. So, I mean, I've been in that position, not on purpose. I was telling a friend of mine, I was teaching him since he was 13, so he was like a member of my family. I said, man, the problem with Latin music is that y'all don't have enough chord progressions. You play on one chord forever. He looked at me and started laughing and said, he said, that's because we have a lot of drums playing. He said, tell me what any one drum is playing. Okay, did I know what a drum was playing? Hell no. He said, that's why you think we need to have more chords. Learn these drum parts, Papa. So now he's like a student of mine, and over these years, he's taught me so much. So even when I write Latin music, I'm always calling him and say, hey, I need some of those Papi Chulo bass lines, or I need, listen to this Papi and make sure decorn it. Don't let me come out here with something corny. And it's something of speaking across these cultures to understand, you know. And we talk about that too with Romanian culture. Just as it's, you think it's easy to translate into other cultures, it's not. So a groove is for real. The blues is for real. It's not something to smile because you can't play it and do 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 the little thing that's corny. What about playing with the reality Train was playing with, or with the reality of Miles or Mahalia Jackson, or those who are the best at that? It's like what we try to do. If we're playing trumpet, we listen to Maurice Andre, or we listen to Herseth, or we listen to any of the great trumpet players, we're not listening to that smiling every time something comes up like, oh, that's a funny little thing to do. We're saying, damn, can we play this? And that's definitely true of a groove. I cracked a joke today. I told him to check out Grandpa Jones. I don't know how many of y'all remember Hee-Haw. And Grandpa Jones would be always stamping his foot like that. I tried to do that stamp one day. I said, boy, damn, that's a hard stamp. And all of these things, you know, are related. We had a bus driver in our septet. His name was Harold Russell. He passed away. We called him the Pit Bull. He's from Tennessee. Well, my man coming home. He's really southern white man. Love Lyle, love it. He would drive Lyle, too. So he would always say, I love y'all, but I love Lyle. And we played in Ryman once. We played a concert in Ryman Auditorium. He said, this is the real Carnegie Hall of America. So it's just his experience, you know, and the kind of reality we have to bring to styles, even of American music that we laugh at or that we bypass, as if our folk music, our grooves, our things don't mean anything. They mean a lot.
So before I want to go to a little bit through the violin concerto and the symphony, one last question that came up was, when and why did you start composing? Like, was this, or, you know, I should say for orchestras, because, you know, you've always been writing stuff for you guys.
Only because of Kurt Mazur. Kurt Mazur's son was the conductor of New York Philharmonic. He'd been at the Leipzig Gewandhaus. He was many things. He's from that long lineage of great German conductors. The Leipzig Orchestra stretched back to Brahms, you know, the tradition they have. His son, Thomas, is a trumpet player. So when I was maybe 29 or something, he came to a gig in Detroit. And he said, friend, will you write something for the New York Philharmonic? So I started laughing. I said, man, I haven't even written for a big band. I'm not going to write anything for New York Philharmonic. You have to be crazy. Like, what makes you think I could? So after that, you know, I knew him. I would go to their concerts sometimes. I would see him. Every time I saw him on the campus of Lincoln Center, he would say, are you still afraid to write for the New York Philharmonic? So it started to make me angry. You know, I said, well, I'm not afraid to write for the New York Philharmonic, are you? So over those 10 years, I started to learn, like I deal with woodwinds. That's why I wrote that piece, Stravinsky piece. I wrote a string quartet. I wrote another piece for the New York City Ballet, Peter Martins. I told him I can't write for orchestra, but can you just, he let me, I wrote a piece trying to figure out how to deal with orchestra and orchestration. Of course, I have friends that would do it. I always talk with them, a guy named Bob Sadin. We go through scores and we talk. Steve Epstein, a producer for many years, he would mark up scores for me. And then Kurt Mazur said, okay, the turn of the new millennium, I want you to write this piece. It's 1999. You get the whole evening. Man, you know, so okay, I worked on the stuff and I started to write it. And he told me before, is one of the deepest conversations I had with a person, he said he had participated in Hitler Youth during Nazism. I said, man, if you were a youth, you participated in it. He said, I'm going to tell you a few things. He said, the first thing I'm going to tell you is that if a person sleeps with another person's wife in a neighborhood, in 2 days, everyone knows. Can you move 6 million people around in your country and kill them and no one knows? Friend, we all knew. He said, what happened to American strain of black and white people coming together? George Gershwin, Bernstein, Duke Ellington, what happened to that? He said, I will tell you that the line between civilization and barbarism is very thin. You think it's some issue because your country is the way it is. All of these countries have things. This is your thing. He said, I want you to try to bring these traditions together. And I want you to try to write a piece that celebrates our common humanity. And I think you can do it. So I wrote this piece. It was like 6 months. I worked day and night. As hard as I ever worked on something. My ears literally were burning. I'm not joking. I was hearing so much music that I couldn't touch them at the end of it. I wore a whole team of copyists. They were in my house just laying down. It's not an exaggeration. Victor Goins, who copies for the jazz band, spent his whole Christmas holidays copying parts, copying. It's just music, music, music. And we played it. It was the worst thing you ever heard. I sat up there. I was like, damn, could I have made this many miscalculations? Because I gave the orchestra a lot of really hard stuff to play. And I did not understand at that time how specific a score has to be. And, you know, it's a longer story. I won't bore you with that. But that started me to writing it. So I worked on that piece. And we played it 10 months later at the Czech National Orchestra. It sounded totally different. You know, they had the tape. Some orchestras get better, like it's mysterious kind of, if you're not from that world, you know. But I always go back to him and the kind of memory of what he was telling me he would like to see done from his vantage point. And that the statement he was interested in was very human, and what he grew up in and what he saw and knew what human beings are capable of if they're not careful. And that was always his point. Be careful, friend. Be careful. You take it for granted. Be careful. So that's it.
Well, I think a lot of you know that my family and I are in a transition moving to Germany. And one of the things that were really beautiful and interesting was trying to pack my musical library, which is, you know, 4,000 plus scores, you know, things that I conduct and I work on. And I have these special boxes of only Winton's music. And I was joking with Cheryl because I have a big box and I had to write what was on it. And I wrote Winton Violin Concerto on a big box. And she said, did you just put one score in that? And I said, no, but these are all the versions that I've conducted of the piece. And I've kept every score because every time we come back to the concerto, you know, Winton will say, I'm going to send you a new score because I've changed some things. And sure enough, I think it was about a week before I arrived here, you know, I got a letter from Jake and said, I'm sending you a new score because we've changed some things. But, you know, it's fascinating to me that, so when you write a piece and you come back to it, and what I've observed over the years, at least with the violin concerto because I've lived the longest, most of the time you remove things that you've written. And you keep, but what happens at the end, and I think you will agree with me when you experience the piece, it brings an unbelievable amount of elegance and the implied gestures that then end up not being there. You know, I think it's really quite a genius process, you know. And when you started, when we started, whatever, a few years ago with this, which, and I'll make a little parenthesis because there were a few questions about how we met. And the violin concerto was about that. And I still remember driving up from Philadelphia. We were going to do this in Chautauqua. And we got a flat tire on the way. So we're late for dinner. And, you know, I got the tire fixed and everything. And we arrive and you guys were waiting on the porch. And I still remember, you know, we're in the car, panicked. Okay, like we got here, like, trying to get the kids were very young, you know, little babies. And Winton comes out and says, "Let me get the bags," and he just took the suitcase and we went inside. So, anyways, but we met the first time just starting to work on the concerto, you know, in the process of this, it just. You know, as soon as you would hear something, Winton would say, okay, measures 3 through 18, tusset English horn, or tusset snare drum, or change this. And I don't think I've ever heard you add things in since then. It's just been a process of removing things, you know? Do you have a system about that, or is it just then what happens?
No, I don't. I go off of... stuff is there, but also you said J.K. J.K. copies music. And the first time I asked him, he was in my house. We were working on All Rise. I said, "Hey, man, can you copy music?" That was 1999. He said, "Man, I don't know. He's a bass player." "Yeah, I'll copy it." And everything I do is really personal. So I saw you and Cheryl, y'all. You know, the babies come up, little cute babies. We start talking, got the Houston connection. David Kirk is my roommate. When I met Juilliard, another Southern boy, he was from Alabama. We called him Bubba. He's playing tuba. Me and him played Rossignol together. We said, "We're going to play this better than all these people from the North. You're from Alabama. I'm from Louisiana." He's been in Houston Symphony for so many years. You know, we start talking about the violin. You stayed up. We did a rehearsal. We did a concert. You stayed up after that concert for 2 or 3 hours, went through the school with me, said, "This would be better done this way. This would be better done that way." We jazz, we are collective. We in our orchestra, we work with each other. We have 10, 11 arrangers. We work together. Sometimes we send one passage out to different members and say, "Could you orchestrate this so I can look at it and study it and see how I could do it better?" We all have different strengths. And to see y'all with your family and the babies in the kind of natural way you are, it's like this community. I've been here many times, you know. I walk in this building, I love it. The great Tim Jackson is here. This stuff is all you have is community. In a way, we're taught to celebrate being away from other people. You get enough money, you can live on top of a mountain. You never have to see anybody, right? My way of being is very different. It's country. I grew up in places like Little Forms, Louisiana, Brobridge. I rely on other people. I respect them. I have a love for their abilities. I listen to their opinions. I try to learn. The greatest thing you have is what you can achieve with a group of people, and people will help you if you have that belief in them. And also, you have more fun. So just from that time, just the meals we've had, you know, at the home, or just now sitting in the back talking with Cheryl, it's not like a job, you know, I have to come in and I'm looking at my watch or something. I don't have to really do that, you know. It's more when it's personal and it's human, then it's another level of honesty, it's another level of connection. And I will change the music until it's done to me. You know, the form does not change. It's coming from you anyway. So I don't have this kind of thing where the fake hierarchy that's existed in European music, where like Beethoven didn't go to the bathroom. He did. You know, people worked on their music. Where Mozart didn't work on his music, he worked on his music. People change stuff. They look at stuff. And we're human beings. We don't have to have this kind of fallacy of one person knows everything. One person does not know. A person knows what they know. And with the help of other people, they would be much, much, much better. And it's a saying we have in the jazz world. It was always, the greatest thing you will ever encounter is another person. The great Art Blakey, who I was honored to play with and learned to play under, used to always tell me, "Hey, man, don't be a drag. People have enough of a drag. If you get out of your own way and get out of people's way, you'll be shocked how much you're going to learn and how much they will embrace you." And I feel like, yeah, the type of time you spent on this was way beyond the time I was paying you to do it. You sat up, we conducted, did all that stuff. Then it's 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. You're looking at the score, talking about, "Man, this right here, put this in boxes, try to do this way, try to do that." You know, yeah. And that's what I take away from my experience more than was something on time, or did people play stuff perfect, or did they, I don't care whether they playing it perfect. You know, I want to leave with a vibe. Or it's like the great Miles Davis, once somebody told him, "Man, Miles, I was really disappointed to find that you had overdubbed these parts on Miles Ahead, or on Sketches of Spain," one of those records with Gil Evans where he did a lot of overdubbing, and Miles said, "You overdub it then." Okay. What he was saying is, you know, okay, you're disappointed by me overdubbing it. Okay, you put your sound on it. Then you're going to call me back. So, yeah, I changed it.
And I think, the program notes that you sent that are printed in the book for tonight's concert, which I strongly encourage everyone to read them, you know, just to familiarize us with the language. But can you, because this has always been so helpful for me when you have, and I think it was the third or the fourth time, or even later when we were recording the concerto, and we were sitting in the recording booth after the first cuts, and you just went through the score and started telling me exactly, said, this is what's happening, and this is, you know, this person is turning the corner, and that's this dream, and all of a sudden it's the nightmare, and, you know, like, and you went through the score this way. Can you do maybe just, you know, go through the concerto a little bit so that we get a little bit of the picture in advance?
So the nightmare, I mean, the concerto was written for Nikki, so she would always have dreams, you know. She was talking about she had this dream, so... It's a dream, and the dream has four sections. The first section is a rhapsody. It's a lullaby, like you're telling a kid, go to sleep. So it's beautiful. Then it's a transitional section, and it goes to a nightmare. Like you fell asleep, and all of a sudden there's dogs barking and police sirens and noise and pandemonium, and that makes you anxious. So there's sections of anxiety where you're doing all those gestural things that you do when you're anxious. Internal tremolo and it's like kind of strange. Augmented, diminished sound out, and you know, so she goes between kind of angsty, nervous, and something bad is happening in this nightmare. Then, as you come out of that nightmare, you come into a peaceful phase. That's the third section, and that peaceful thing I was trying to evoke, like John Coltrane, where he would play on records like Crescent and things that had really kind of, for all the turmoil of the 1960s, Train played with a great deal of very gentle for 1963-64 Train. Now, once he got to 66, okay, he still was relaxed, but he was a little more urgent. So I tried to get that kind of peaceful blues quality with the orchestra swaying up and down, voice like McCoy Tyner would play, with the French horn Lontano in the background and the strings just singing another melody, you know, based on that first rhapsodic theme, but peaceful blues. Then after that section, it returns to the rhapsody. It's like you're coming out of the dream in the It's rhapsodic, but it's in a higher register. It's like the lullaby has been transformed by the dream. And then the fourth section at the end is a Celtic, like a bunch of old druids sitting around a campfire telling some lies. That, you know, my favorite poet in the world is William Butler Yeats. So I've read more damn Yeats poetry driving across the country than people. They had to tell me at a certain year, please stop reading this man's poetry out loud to us. But the whole kind of Celtic, and the Anglo-Celtic thing is a very important root of Afro-American music. So I give her this boom, 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 which is New Orleans, Mardi Gras Indian clave with bones and tambo, like in the minstrel show. So I got bones, the tambourine, chick, 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 chick. And on top, she's playing really abstract melodic language in the kind of connected way of triads and all this kind of thing. There's no, I could give you a theoretical definition of it, it would bore you. And she's boom, boom, boom. She's way in the high register because that to me is extreme memory. Like, you know, the scientists say that our genes have memories. So whatever our genetic makeup is, we have memory, ancient memories, memories, memories. So at the end of that, you start with a lullaby, which is your mom or, you know, whoever's singing the preferably your mother, not your father, is going to sing that lullaby. And at the end, it's like ancestral. And I'm very much aware that it is a female delivering it. Because for me, in almost all of my music, in All Rise, in Blood on the Fields, all these pieces, always the central character is always a woman. I don't know why. It's not a part of the whole movement now, let's recognize women. Because my mom was recognized women in the 50s, and she was alone. But it's just that thing of Cassandra Wilson in Blood on the Fields, or Lady singing All Rise, or the kind of wisdom that a female represents connected to the moon, connected to something. They live in the earth. We live on top of the earth a certain way. And in my mythology, and what I notice around the world when I go to people's homes, that's what I notice. I was just in Marseillac, France, last week, talking with a guy who drove from Portugal, a young saxophone player, just because he heard I was there. He told me that. I said, hey, man, I'm going to take you out. Let's go get some, let's go eat. I randomly went into a restaurant that had a certain type of ham that I won a prize of being a member of the ham of Big Oar. You know, it's like a black ham. And there's a guy who was cutting the ham that I was saying, man, you need to come to America. So I was telling him, I said, you picked a restaurant. He picked a restaurant. I walked in. I said, man, I was in this restaurant last year. And the guy was here. I forgot his name. We're talking about him coming to America with this ham. We're sitting down. I'm telling him what I thought about females and males. I said, if you go into somebody's home anywhere in the world, who's going to pull their family album out? So he said, a man. I said, what? How many homes have you been in, man? It's almost always a woman. So he said, I don't know if that's true. I said, okay. Right after that, a lady came up. And she said, you were here last year with my brother. My brother was the guy that was cutting that ham for me. I said, yeah. She said, let me show you. She opened her phone up and she showed me pictures of me with her brother. This is true. I started looking at him. Now I remember, Jay, man, I love this guy. You know, just his kind of spirit. And she said, my brother died. Then she started to cry. Now, we're in a restaurant packed with people. You know, it's in Marsac. Everybody kind of knows me. I stood up. I hugged the woman. And she said, it's okay. You know, here, we country people. We understand. We kill things and we eat them. You live and you die. You know, so it's not sorrow. I loved him. And she said, wow, it's good to see you. I'm going to bring you some of this ham before you leave. So I looked at him. I said, you see, a man wouldn't have did that. He'd have been like, okay, man. I said, take care, man. You know, so, yeah. So when I write the violin concerto, it's very much for a woman, and it's very much for her because of her complexity. And a lot of the things I learned in the concerto was from her. Like, you can't. What could I say about somebody that she played? I get like a list of like 70 things that were wrong. I would be thinking, damn, but could you play and think about all this thing? A bass drum on beat two should be mezzo piano with a staccato mark in the second measure. It wasn't big things. It was always like, what is the dynamic of the flute in measure 35? Or what is the, I think the kind of practical aspect of orchestration, I learned things from her, like about the terms. I like to use my own terms. She was like, you can use your own terms if you want, but that's 10 minutes of a rehearsal gone. So, you know, all that kind of stuff, very practical stuff she would tell me. And also, you know, technical thing. I learned many things doing it. So that's the first movement. And that first movement is reflected in all the other movements. So the kind of crazy part of the first movement, the anxious part, becomes the vibe of the second movement, but it's a burlesque. So I'm from New Orleans. I grew up Mardi Gras, people drunk, people with masks on, people in the circus. So the burlesque kind of thing in the second movement, she sounds like a bird. She's singing. We had a Jewish wedding. We playing in the circus. Then the third movement is a reflection of that blues section I told you was like Coltrane. So I go into the blues in the third movement, and that is like sex next to the sanctified. In the first movement, I got like four measures. It's like something sexy next to the church. So I go from the sexy to the sanctified. And that's how the blues movement goes. It's sexy, then it goes to the church, the tambourines and trombones hollering. I love all that stuff. I try to put that in everything. I think it's really an American experience that's in all of our music, though it is associated with the Afro-American tradition. It's a lot of the good holiness preachers, white preachers in the South that can tell you what it is also. And then it goes from there to a kind of pastoral passage. Then it goes to a section where you've been married for a long time and the person you love for many years is dead and it's just you. So it's beyond loneliness. And in that I have the orchestra inhaling. And when they play, it's the exhale because I want them to get that feeling of something that's deeper than pain. It's so painful, there's a joy in it and an acceptance. And I've seen that many times just because I grew up with a lot of jazz musicians and was always in their homes. It was always of the older generation. And many of them I saw pass away and I would see their spouse after that. And the feeling was always so pregnant and heavy. And many times also it's difficult to describe in words, you know. And in music, I put words to stuff because it's good to tell these stories. But when you put it in music, it's not those words. You know, it's the thing that the word is trying to, like the great Ornette Coleman, just tell the story. Tell if I'm going too much, I like to tell all these stories. My daddy and mama talked a lot, forgive me. I went to see Ornette Coleman one night. My father had played with him in the 1950s, and he was very familiar toward me. 1 o'clock in the morning, I would come to his apartment, and he opened the door. He knew I was coming. He said, "Get your horn out." There's no talking. I went in the room with him. I sat down there. He sat down across from me. He started playing. "Hey, it's Ornette Coleman. You know, he plays with..." I felt like I wanted to just throw my horn away because he plays with so much expression when he plays. So he told me, we were playing. He said, "Man..." So he could feel I was insecure. He said, "Man..." He talked with a lisp. He said, "Man, don't let people make you feel insecure about your playing, man. You can play, man. I was listening to you. You know, you got something in your playing that's very, very deep. When you play things, you know how you're talking to somebody and they'll say..." Now that "I," that means a lot, and that's not a word. That's more music in that than in the word that came before it. That's what you need to think about. So that was a deep lesson he put on me, 1:45 or something in the morning, off of him sensing my insecurity trying to play with him. Because he played with so much expression, you really wanted to just throw your horn. Because we're playing melodies. Oh, this guy just invention, melodic invention, unbelievable. Notes swell up and they swell out. It's literally like connotations, like he's talking to you. And I always think about that in music, like about what he said about the kind of human, the connotations and stuff. And that's so that third movement ends with that. And then it goes right into a hootenanny. That's because I square danced. And it's also because of something that Willie Nelson told me. He said when he was young, he was playing in the Grand Ole Opry. He was playing with older musicians. And he said he was playing bass. He said, "We wanted to play guitar." He said, "When he's playing bass, every time he changed a note, they would go, 'Watch that bass, boy. Watch that bass.'" So he said, "Who cares? Nobody can even hear the bass." So one of the old timers told him, "When that bass changed, everything changed. A guitar can change all night. Nobody cared. He's just making faces at the girls." And it's just, for me, like, it's really bottom, root, groove-oriented, and also, for me, embracing a groove. Like, I want the orchestra and everybody to get deep in the groove as we can get. We're not trying to show that we're philosophically angst from turgid 19th century German philosophy that led to 2 world wars. We're thinking of something else. We're thinking about a hold down. And there's great thought and great music that comes out of all types of experiences. Like last night, we were listening to the I can't even mispronounce their names. The piece you play for your brothers from Romania. There's a lot in that. You know, a lot of complexity and graciousness. So you see, we go through tour of the country in that fourth movement. We're in the West at one time with the type of Western hold down. Then another time we kind of in the Appalachian region doing that kind of thing. Then we got a little Chinese music that we throw them in there. They like to do that kind of thing too. Related to us through the pentatonic scale and the cymbals. And you heard in Tandoon's piece last night, he started grooving with those water drums. It's the basic same kind of concept of groove that we use. And for her, I just want her to fiddle, you know. I want to be like a fiddler who can play. It's my real country. But the turnaround is the changes of Coltrane's giant steps, like an augmented progression. It's not that obvious when an orchestra does it, but that's, and then, you know, was that enough? I don't want to make Cheryl mad. Hey, Cheryl.
And we have all this in the program book as well, the description as well as the symphony, which is another work that it's, you know, similar in the progression of why the movements are in the order that they are. And I did actually just a little parenthesis secret. After the first rehearsal, we were talking, and Winton always asked me, how was it? What, tell me what you see, or tell me what you heard. And so I wrote him, and I said, you know, it sounds great. I said, I have questions about the order of the movements. That was the first thing that I said. And I got back this unbelievable text message just explaining to me why every movement is exactly what it is and why it needs to remain there. You know, and it was a great lesson for me.
You know, I didn't mind changing it. I just wanted you to react to it. Because when he tells me stuff, you know, once again, it's like he's giving me a lot of suggestions, never gratuitous, kind of letting me talk. It's always like, hey, this would be better, do this, you change this, it's too hard to do, take this out. So I'm always asking him, actually, what do you see that I could change? What should be different? Or what was, And I mean, he'll tell me, so I'm grateful for that.
But now it's perfect the way that it is because it really follows. And of course, I didn't change anything, but, you know, understanding the thought of why the movements are where they are, just as an encouragement to I guess, you know, take a couple of minutes to read before the concert tonight. So, well, Winton, we're so happy that you are here with us. We can't wait for you to come back. And after tonight.
Thank you all very much. Thank you so much. Thank you, Kristen.